Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Hey guys, welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech podcast and radio show. This week we come to you from sunny Las Vegas. Actually, it was a bit chilly in Las Vegas and Kuala Lumpur and elsewhere around the world. Jason and I were out and about at, of course, Money 2020, another big, massive fintech program, event out in Vegas. Caught up with a lot of our old friends there, Ron Shevlin, Dave Birch, etc. It was, it's sort of like, you know, it's become this massive networking thing more than just the conference, of course. So we got the opportunity to catch up with Peter Hazelhurst and talk about the huge news about Uber Money's global release. So without further ado, let's cross to my interview with Peter Hazelhurst. I'm in the Venetian at Money 2020 with Peter Hazelhurst. Now, Peter is a fellow Aussie.
I am.
A reformed Aussie.
A reformed Aussie with interesting heritage as an aunt who was on television for a long time.
Oh, really? Who was your aunt?
She'd be Noni.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah, she taught you to sing.
Yes, there you go.
Exactly.
As long as you didn't say Rolf Harris, we're good.
Oh, really? No. She did do A Place to Call Home. That's her most recent
treat. There you go. And of course, you like me, you're a dual citizen, British and Aussie citizenship.
I was born at the Radcliffe in Liverpool, in Oxford, and moved to Australia when I was 18 weeks old.
Okay, so my mum was from Birmingham. That's how I got my Aussie, my British passport.
Yeah.
But I was born in Melbourne.
So. I grew up in Canberra, which is equally bad.
Canberra.
Yeah.
There you go. And you've been in the States now for how long?
I moved to the US in 1993, so whatever that's, 26 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah, long time.
I left Oz in 99 and went to Hong Kong, then Dubai, and then ended up here. So, anyway.
Yeah, long time.
Yeah, let's get to... talking about Uber. Now, you of course, you're well known. You've been involved in all sorts of things in the fintech space, Google Wallet for quite a time, and you've been with Uber now for
almost 18 months.
Okay.
Yeah. So relatively new to Uber. Joined in this sort of new and amazing space for Uber, where there's this new experience where everything's getting reborn, the risk-taking culture that had been super exciting earlier, now is moving into a place where we're really about thinking about what can we do best for our customers, and it's a really great place.
Mm.
Dara's been instrumental in this transformation for the company from where we used to be to this place where people are just excited and jazzed about how can we build things that really, really matter at scale.
So describe to me the problem that Uber has with trying to get all their drivers paid, make sure they've got bank accounts, because I recall back in, it must be around 2013, 2014 now, where Uber was actually, trying to recruit drivers and couldn't because they didn't have bank accounts, you know?
Yeah. So it's a really interesting dynamic for us. So we're pretty global. We're in about 65 countries right now. And one of the challenges that we have is that first things first, we need to make sure that riders, people that are ordering food on Uber Eats and so on, can pay the way they want to pay. And for you and me, that's using a debit or credit card. Maybe we use PayPal or Venmo or something like that in the US. Around the world, it's everything that you can imagine, from different sorts of local debit card networks to maybe they pay with a local wallet like Alipay or something like that. And then surprisingly, it's a lot of people around the world that are paying in cash. And, you know, to give you a perspective, 40% of trips worldwide on Uber are paid in cash,
I've never used cash on Uber, but I've done it. I've used it in 16 countries or so. And the great benefit is I can go anywhere in the world and bill all of my trips back to the same card.
And that's a core plan for us at Uber, which is that the experience that you have is a global experience. And as we were thinking a lot about how we build financial services, there's an easy or almost a lazy tendency to just say, I'll just do what makes sense for the local market, irrespective of whether it's the best experience, you know. And if you're a major retail bank, you know, you end up with an amazing experience for your US customers, a kind of an okay experience for your British customers, and a not so great experience for your Indian customers.
Right.
We just don't
you
go there.
You can't.
As Uber, we have the same experience worldwide, no matter what. And what that means, which is really interesting, is if you, Brett, are riding on Uber in India, and the average driver there is expecting to be paid in cash, we have an imbalance.
Yeah.
And what that means is what we require of all of our drivers on Uber is that they have a bank account that we can pay them. Because even though they might do cash trips every other day, some international traveler like you or me is going to land on the ground and pay with their American Express right. card or their City Chase, whatever. And they're going to need the ability to pay. The problem for the driver is they're hoping you paid in cash because they want that real-time immediacy of payment, but they're going to get paid digitally. And for us at Uber, maybe it takes a day or so for us to get settled up with one of the credit card issuers. And for the driver, they're going to say, well, where's my money? And for us, we then thought about, like, well, how do we make sure that every driver has a bank account? And one of the things that's really awesome about Uber is that we have empowered our local city ops managers to figure out how to solve these sort of problems. And so one of the women on my team, Abby, she used to be the city manager in Lagos, Nigeria. And Abby's fantastic. And she was like, how do I create a marketplace for Uber drivers in Lagos? First thing she needed to do is solve how do they get paid. And the Uber office was like on the fourth floor of a nondescript office building. We choose nondescript office buildings to mitigate people wanting to figure out where Uber works. And downstairs in the bottom in retail was some local branch, bank branch. And she walked downstairs. She did a deal personally on her own with no permission from anybody and said, look, I want to make sure that if I onboard these drivers, you'll give them a bank account. And she did it. And it was really cool.
So you're doing the KYC for the banks?
We totally do the KYC. We authenticate the user. We make sure that they are, quote, have a job, which for many of our customer, or many of our bank partners around the globe, the first thing they wanted to make sure is there a point in giving these people a bank account? And we pushed the envelope really, really hard and made sure that they thought having access and being a driver on Uber was a great job right. and that this was something that made sense for them to have a bank account. The bank then had to do their own KYC too, so it wasn't like we were stepping into that process for them. But what was important was we were validating that this person should have a bank account.
Now, assuming they have to have a driver's license, so they've got most of what's required to do KYC anyway, but then you've also given them validation for...
You know, I think it's really interesting. So if you think of a lot of the economies that we operate in, banking and financial services are considered a privilege for some. And if you take, for example, in Mexico, so we launched our driver debit card in Mexico in July. And what was really interesting, part of the reason we did it was 35% of drivers that came to us and onboarded had never had a bank account before they came to Uber. This was a great unlock.
What were the numbers like in the US?
The US was much different. Well, was it much different? I don't know.
I think it was about 30% at one point, right?
There's been a considerable uplift of drivers that we've helped in the US as well. But I think what we've figured out over time is that the needs for fundamentally financial services are global. They're not specific to a particular geo. And what we see in macro is that there's this same universal need, that they people that gravitate to the Uber platform want access to earnings. They want access to work. And we create this amazingly flexible platform that if you want to work on a Thursday afternoon from 3 to 5, you can do that. And if that's your only interval, work 3 to 5. If actually you're a nurse during the night and you want to work Sunday mornings 9 to 9, you can do that too. We create that flexibility. And what was really important to us as we realized that we were creating this opportunity to earn was how could we speed up the time to get paid?
So this was part of the innovation you did with your Green Dot GoBank partnership here in the US, right? You know, it was not just the, you could onboard a driver in the app. That was a pretty big innovation. But there was also benefits to how drivers would get paid. So how have drivers utilized that capability?
It's kind of interesting. So one of the things that we figured out was that drivers were actually needing to pay themselves multiple times per day. It seems kind of counterintuitive for you and me, because we're privileged and we're lucky that we have an average daily balance of our bank account of $100, $500, things like that.
But these guys would have to get paid in order to buy fuel?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And actually, what was really interesting, and one of the things that we did with Green Dot, is we launched in such a way that instead of even starting with a balance, we let the driver go negative if they needed to, first thing in the morning. And here's what's kind of interesting about that. So we offered this fee-free overdraft, and it unlocked this amazing...
That's a pretty big innovation for the US right
there. Fee-free overdraft is a big deal. Like, regular overdraft in the US is $34.95.
Yeah.
But here's how interesting it was. 56% of drivers in the US are eligible and have tried it once. Out of those, 60% of those drivers use the overdraft six or more times per month.
Wow.
So think about that. So...
It does build a lot of loyalty.
It builds a... Yes, but that's actually...
But there's a
bonus
region.
Benefit.
Right.
The real outlook here is we wanted to help drivers in their financial journey. And they spend and they earn, they spend and they earn. That's how it is. They earn on the platform and then they go buy groceries for the family. They earn on the platform, they pay for their kids to get out of daycare. But when they start in the morning and their balance is zero because they've just spent everything, right, what do they do? The normal thing that they would do, unfortunately, is they get a same day payday loan. And for you and me, you're like, why would you do that? The answer is, if you have nothing, what are you going to do?
Yeah, then I got no other choice.
And these deals are not great. $50 of gas equals $55 at the end of the day. And it only seems like $5. In the abstract, $5 over 5 hours doesn't seem so bad conceptually. But if you APR that thing, it's N,000%.
Yes.
And it's not in the interests of our drivers and partners to do that. And we're lucky with this new part of Uber that we're working on called Uber Money to have this opportunity to actually set a new tone of how people should be included in the financial services
world. So here we get to the big news. So you're launching this week in Vegas, Uber Money.
Yeah.
And you've already laid out some of the problems for us, is that geographical constraints in terms of the way banking operates is inefficient for you. So how do you solve the problem? How do you give drivers bank accounts across this disparate landscape, give them instant payment capabilities, have the ability to, I'm assuming you, apart from doing things like, these overdraft facilities, you might look at helping them with car leasing and things like that as well. So Uber Money, tell us more about it, how it emerged and what the intent is.
It fundamentally starts with the customer. And if you build products that are fundamentally right and good for customers, it's pretty hard to make a mistake. Our customer is a person that is earning flexibly on the platform, which is great. They need to get access to their earnings as quickly as possible. So the first thing we did is we took this experience that we'd had in these cash markets where you do a cash trip, you get paid, and physically you get the money. And you know what's really interesting? So in Brazil, as a result of some of the ideas of how to help our drivers, we introduced this option that said, opt out of cash trips. Thinking, you know, if you're at the end of the day and you didn't want to take any more cash trips, you'd take credit card. The reverse happened. Drivers were opting in for cash trips because they needed the immediacy of the money. So the big change that we're making, that we're launching today, tomorrow, is this idea that in real time, after every trip, we pay you. And we put the money that you have, as a driver, have earned from your customer, the rider, or if they're an eater on Eats, and we deposit that in real time to your bank account.
That's pretty impressive.
It's real time. It's game changing.
You're launching it here in the US first, or you're rolling
out
of multiple countries?
In Q1, we're launching in Brazil and Mexico, and then we're going to go across the whole of our platform.
So how have you dealt with this on a regulatory basis? Because you've already got, obviously, bank and payment processing companies and partners. So
So globally, we have a pretty amazing infrastructure. So we're in 65 countries. In our first big market, Europe, that's international, we've now got our own e-money license. So we're part of the regulatory infrastructure in Europe. And in process around the world, we're participating as a first-class citizen. So we have an amazing compliance team that's focused on making sure that whatever we do in payments is at the highest level of integrity. It's expensive to do that. So we're not doing this for fun. We're doing it because we think it's really important. Pragmatically, we're a company that loves to go fast. And so what that means is me and my team figure out who we can partner with on a global basis in each country to unlock this capability. In the US, we're partnering really, really well with Green Dot. In Mexico, we partner with BBVA. In Brazil, we're partnering with Hub, and so on and so forth. So we look pragmatically, how can we get to market first or quickly? Because we know what we're doing is good and that the more people we can impact is better. And then over time, we look at how can we get a further foothold in the financial services ecosystem, just as a pure pragmatic basis. Mm. On a global basis, many of the regulators look at our scale and say, we really want to understand what you're doing. And so we respond very positively and actively in that way.
And have any of those regulators come to you and said, we really think you guys should be your own bank? Or
no one's ever said that we think you should be a bank. In some of our markets, Europe and Mexico is two examples, they've said we'd like you to have a payments license. And so we've
some regulatory...
That. Yeah, it's very much the part of our DNA to be listening to the regulators in every market, particularly in financial services, and responding to their request for, hey, either provide us due diligence and confirmation that you're meeting all the worldwide KYC and AML requirements, which we do on a global basis, or in certain geos like Europe, please actually contribute fully as a contributor into the network.
So talk to me about Uber Money in terms of its scale. In where you think it will be in Q1 next year, and then where could it be a few years from now?
So one way to think about it is this, right? So on a global basis, we have about 4 million active drivers and couriers to whom we make sure that the earnings that they get from their customers get paid no less frequently than weekly, in many markets daily, and now in real time in the US and soon in Brazil. So that's sort of one side of the marketplace. The other side of the marketplace is over 100 million riders and eaters. And when I say 100 million, I mean monthly active users, people that are every month saying, I want to ride on Uber, or I want to have some food. So that marketplace is pretty dynamic and it's global. We do that without consideration for how the rider wants to pay, which means it's a high burden. So we have 100 plus, more than that, engineers whose only job is to figure out all new ways of paying for Uber across the globe, whether it's adding Alipay here or Bcash in Bangladesh or whatever. We're constantly adding things. We actually sort of thought about how to do that at scale and finally said the actual answer is to open up the way to push money.
Yeah.
And we launched Uber Pay, which is a public API that anyone can push money into Uber Cash, which is our stored value account. One of the things that we're launching tomorrow is Uber Wallet, which is the roll-up of that wallet payment experience globally. And as we do that, suddenly we're actually creating this single experience across Uber, rider, driver, eater, courier, you name it, where you can see your balance, you can see what credit cards you have on file, you can see any transactions you've done on the platform. And the big transition that we did as part of this work on the driver side is we brought all of the online banking experience into the driver app. So Uber Wallet for our drivers is the full end-to-end wallet banking experience. No longer do you need a separate app to understand what transactions happened. In real time, you get notifications when you charge. And more importantly, we'll help you on that journey to start saving. So we've built in cashback. So if you're a regular driver on Uber, you get 3% cashback on gas. If you're a Diamond Pro driver, you actually get 6% cashback, which is a big deal. Mm. Nobody pays cashback on debit card. But we think it's important to help create a new ecosystem.
Now, you've recently talked about merging the driver and food app.
Mm-hmm.
And you've now got the driver.
I mean the rider and the food app.
Sorry, the rider and
food. Yeah, Eats. Yeah, we call it the super app.
Uber Eats and the Uber car service, right?
Yeah.
And now you've got a wallet mixed in there. It sounds more and more like, you know, the Chinese super wallets that are emerging.
The super apps, yeah.
Right. Absolutely. Now, so do you think that is, you know, if we all go with these wallet ecosystems, they give us access to this layer of services, which makes sense because payments don't happen on their own. They're embedded in some other service or experience. So 10, 20 years down the track, where does that leave banks who are currently issuing value stores? I know they're your partners right now, so you're going to be careful.
But
I'm putting the futurist hat on.
Take care. look, I think if I was a big retail bank, one of the things I would be wanting to try and figure out how not to be is how not to be the major telcos of the 80s and 90s who thought they had this embedded privilege, which was a government license to issue data and voice. And having worked at Nokia and been on the other side of that trade, I know that there was this sort of incumbent experience. I'm an operator in my country. I'm in defense. I'm like impenetrable. There's nothing you can do. And then along came prepaid and along came all of these disruptive business models. And the prepaid businesses were operating on top of the banks, which is a lot like the Chimes and others that are operating on top of existing banking licenses. So the playbook of disruption in financial services is akin to the playbook of disruption in mobile, with one big difference: that time has marched on, and when the disruptions were happening in mobile, there was not really an internet yet.
Right.
And now the cost of building is so much easier. And so I think it's a challenging place to be if I was a big retail bank, because the franchise that they believe they have can easily be disrupted by companies that have a great experience with customers. And if you look at us as Uber, one of the things that we do, I believe, is have a fundamentally customer-centric brand experience, where we think it's important that when you open the app and you want to get somewhere, it just works. And one of the things that is really important to us is not disrupting that core need. If you need food for dinner, we'll help you make that happen with Uber Eats. Soon we'll be launching grocery with Corner Shop. You need dinner groceries, we'll make that happen. If you can't pay for it, it's kind of a broken process. We'll let you pay however you wish. And most importantly, for the people that are on the platform having this as their earning opportunity, we want to make sure there's no delay between the time that you did the service and the time you get paid for that service. If we can do that, I think we've solved something really interesting.
So this does become a template for sort of the gigging economy worker. I mean, you know, if you're renting out Airbnb or you're on some other gigging economy platform, you're going to expect to be paid instantly now. That's the implication, right?
I actually think, so yes, for the gig economy, for sure. But I don't think there's anything special about the gig economy here.
I think it's just everyone.
Yeah, I think fundamentally the model that you get paid 2 weeks
It doesn't make sense, 2 weeks.
It's an anachronism that was legally sort of justified when accounting was bullshit and it was hard to do.
Yeah,
but it isn't anymore. Like, my iPhone knows how many hours I work for Uber. It's 23 a day. Stop smiling. but it does. And why should I have to wait until the middle of the month or the end of the month to get paid?
Doesn't make any sense.
I'm lucky enough, and we're lucky enough, that we actually have the floatability. So we've created a buffer that says, yeah, you know what? If I get paid on the 15th and the 31st, I can make it work. But many people can't.
We see this globally. Why should a payday lender be able to charge you 1,000% for 2 weeks, but your employer is able to loan that money off you for 2 weeks interest-free?
There's a legitimate argument for that. And I think the argument is not in the worker's benefit.
Right.
And what we seek to do is to mitigate that and to make it possible for you as a worker to be able to pay your bills when you need to. Because it's not like Verizon says, hey, cool, I know you're getting paid on the 31st, pay me back next time.
Right.
Our goal is to try and collapse that time delta. And more importantly, if we can do that, stop you getting into the situation of having to make the no choice, bad choice. Because the reality is, if you have zero when it starts today and you need to pay for gas, you have no choice. you need to get some sort of funding. We use overdraft to help our drivers and partners do that, but not everyone gets that privilege. Going forward, one of the other things that we're going to work on starting tomorrow or announcing tomorrow is our partnership with BlackRock and Common Sense on using behavioral economics to help people save. And this is a big deal. So now imagine we're doing every trip, we're paying the driver. And one of the things you can do there that's relatively easy for a driver to figure out or to accept is, what if we just save 10 cents on every trip? On a trip basis, 10 cents, they're not going to notice until they get to the end of the month and they've realized they've saved $50. And for you and me, saving $50 doesn't seem like much. But for a person who actually spends every penny and every dollar that they've earned,
it's a big deal.
A new secret stash of $50, that's actually a huge deal.
Yeah. So I know you guys are announcing this tomorrow, but of course this show's airing on Thursday. In New York and across the world. So where can people find out more about Uber Money if they're looking for it? Obviously, it's going to be in the press, but if drivers are interested in this, if riders and eaters are interested in this, where will they go?
So starting tomorrow, a couple of things are going to change. One of the things is we're going to also announce a new credit card with Barclays where you get 5% cash back on all your trips. So if you ride on Uber, and I hope you do, your best benefit that you can get is get yourself a credit card because you get 5% back. All of that paid in Uber Cash. So there'll be in-app experience changes. As we rebrand the payments tab, it'll become Uber Wallet, and you'll see up in the top right corner a balance that represents what you have. For the drivers, there'll be outreach that starts in a couple of weeks' time, encouraging them to get the new debit card. If you're a new driver starting in January, you'll start to speak just through the onboarding flow, hey, get a free bank account powered by GoBank.
Do you guys operate the bin or does GoBank operate
the bin? GoBank operates the bin.
Okay.
And so we're never going to be a bank. That's not the mission. The mission is access to financial services.
You're the glue.
We're the glue, we're the experience, and we're the orchestrators, and I'll call us the aggregators of the best value for our customers. Because we've got this amazing ability to navigate and to negotiate with the big merchants, we can basically go to the likes of Verizon and say, hey, look, we have zillions and zillions of riders on and drivers on Uber. Give us a discount. You give 20% friends and family. Let's call it 40% because we've got many more customers.
Mm.
To give you something really crazy, here's a good one. I'll give you this one. Drivers on Uber purchased more gas last year than Costco sold.
That's a pretty good stat.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
And if you think about that, what that means is if we can work with our merchant partners, they should want to partner with us because it's going to be great for them to get volume.
So when are you guys going to be pushing for EVs?
So we have a whole bunch of activity on electric vehicles.
Yeah, of course.
Particularly in the UK, we have a whole active program. And we actually have effectively, I don't think it's 25 cents a trip. I want to say it's 11 cents a trip or something like that. We're actually putting money aside to help drivers get electric vehicles in the UK as part of a global gas initiative or whatever you call it, eco initiative.
So just to sort of wrap this up, because I'm mindful of time, for organizations like Uber, and increasingly there's organizations like yourselves that are working in multi-jurisdictions, cross-border, so forth, would you say that the time of these geographically restricted banking operations, would you say that the time has come to sort of rethink that?
I think one of the big challenges, in particular with financial services regulation, is that it's very country by country. And one of the things that we see on a global basis is this concept of know your customer. And what the challenge for us is this: we can prove you, Brett, are you, and onboard you and work with Green Dot and get you a bank account. But the moment you take a second journey with us and say, hey, would it be okay for me to get a bank account from somebody else? We have to start again. And this concept of identity and on a global basis is really fundamentally structurally broken.
And given that the data we've used for identity historically is no longer really securable either, right? Your date of birth, your address.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like
your mother's maiden name.
Many countries' KYC says, where do you live? And what's your phone number?
Right.
Maybe your birthday.
Yeah.
None of which is particularly proprietary, none of which is particularly hard to find. And almost all of it, which is on the dark web.
Right. And if you and if you're gonna send me something by mail, I don't wanna work with you. It's ridiculous, right?
And ironically, some banks choose the delivery and the confirmation of receipt of physical mail as proof of identity.
It's crazy.
Yeah. So look, I think for us on a global basis, the challenge is this. We want the same experience worldwide for everybody. And that means that we as a team have to do the hard work to make that experience awesome. We have incredible skills around understanding data that makes it possible for that to occur. And the yield for us is the following. If you're a driver partner of ours and you have an account that we help you get, our mission in life is to make every dollar you earn go further. We're starting at what I think is pretty good at like 10%. And if we get where we need to be, it'll be in the 15 to 20% range. And that for me means we've really succeeded.
Fantastic. Well, Peter Hazelhurst, thanks for introducing us to Uber Money and the thanks, Uber mate. Wallet. And it's great to see you again.
Fantastic. Lovely.
So the team at Uber clearly are believers in the super app model that WeChat sort of pioneered out in Southeast Asia and Africa. And now, of course, Grab has got into that space and others. So it also speaks to the fact that increasingly things like account opening become more experiential and contextual. They depend on what you'll be using the account for as much as anything else. So the old distribution methods around branch, clearly Uber doesn't believe that sort of play for scaling their business is viable. Coming up after the break, of course, Jason is going to catch up with Larky, a new firm that looks at nudge engagement and advertising across mobile platforms. And we speak with their CEO and founder, Greg Hammerman, and their CMO, James Burdeen. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Breaking Banks. Hey guys, it's Brett King from Breaking Banks here. I wanted to introduce you to one of our new sponsors. They're a company called the Online Trading Academy. Now, let's be honest, most people weren't taught investments in school. Not unless you went to college and did specifically a finance degree or completed one of the specialist investment courses. And so you're probably looking at the stock market, seeing it blow up and saying, if I'd only got in 10 years ago, if I'd only done this. Now, if you want to be involved in the trading space, investing online, running that yourself, you have to figure out what are the mistakes that investors commonly make, how do I manage risk in my portfolio, how can I develop a second income, a wealth education plan for my family. That's the sort of framework that the Online Trading Academy will give you. Now, to kick this off, they offer special briefing sessions in person where you can do a free 3-hour introductory course to learn about these elements of trading and investing. You sign up for this free 3-hour introductory class at otatrade.com/fintech. So they have free classes in your area. All you need to do is go along and register at otatrade.com/fintech. You'll even receive their professional insiders kit just for attending the program. That's otatrade.com/fintech. This week's Breaking Banks podcast is brought to you by privacy.com. Privacy.com lets you buy stuff online using a virtual credit card number instead of your real credit card. This protects your identity, protects you from fraud, theft of your bank information, and stuff like this on the internet. Recently, I was able to use privacy.com for an online purchase of some movie memorabilia from one of my favorite TV shows, Fringe. But this was a site I really wasn't familiar with. I wasn't sure how they were going to handle my credit card information. was a little bit uncertain, so I was able to use privacy.com to complete my transaction and protect my information. You don't have to worry about canceling subscriptions or trials if you use one of these temporary credit card numbers. You can set spending limits for yourself for each of these card numbers you set up or collectively. You don't have to worry about your card information getting hacked. That's the real beauty of this. So head to privacy.com/fintech. That is privacy.com, privacy.com/fintech. FINTECH, obviously. And as a special treat for Breaking Banks listeners, new customers signing up today will automatically get $5 to spend on your first purchase. Yep, that's free money to use on any online purchase where you use privacy.com. So check it out, privacy.com/fintech, and sign up today.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag #BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to the second segment of Breaking Banks, joined by Greg Hammerman and James Burdine, CEO and CMO of Larkey, a Michigan-based company that is in the location-based services, something when I was a venture capitalist close to 20 years ago now, I hate to admit that, we talked a lot about LBS and the future it hold. And, you know, a lot of times innovation takes a lot longer to come to fruition, but it really is starting to take hold. And, you know, from our perspective at Breaking Banks, we talk quite a bit about changing user expectations in terms of relevance and timing. And that's really part of what intrigued me when I met the leadership team at Finastra Universe a couple of weeks ago about the problem they're going after to solve. And so, Greg, I'd love to start with you as the co-founder. What problem did Larkey originally set out to solve?
It's a great question. So really, I took this on from a consumer point of view. I am a member of a credit union here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I have banking relationships with a couple financial institutions, and I know in the back of my head that they have products and services that are good for me, that they may have great rates on an auto loan, or they may be able to help me finance the next project I'm doing on my house. But what was happening was I would forget about those relationships when I was out and about. You know, in the moment when I'm buying a car or doing a project, it's really easy to sort of get sucked into the conversation from the car salesman about, hey, we can finance that for you here, and not really think about your community financial institution. So when we got started out, we were really helping these organizations and helping banks and credit unions and saying, hey, we can bridge that gap. With location services, we can help when someone is at a specific location, and we learned a lot, and we can talk more about this in a few minutes, about certain behaviors at those locations. We can really figure out what people are up to. We can tell you that, hey, this person's shopping for a car. It's a Saturday afternoon. They've been to 3 car dealerships. They're spending more than a half hour there. It may be an appropriate time to present them with a message reminding them that their bank or credit union can help them finance that car. And that really spiraled and grew out from there, thinking really closely with our clients and thinking, what are other behaviors in the world that can really tell us what people are doing and really be helpful for you to reach out to them with just specific products or services or other ways the financial institution can help?
So it's not just about geofencing. They walked onto the car lot. You know, I don't know why all location-based services seems to orient around either making me an offer about a restaurant or I'm supposed to be buying a car. But so I'm walking onto the car lot, but it's doing more than just saying I'm on the car lot. You're measuring intent through additional information like the dwell time and the fact that there were more. Do you pull in any additional kind of information?
So we've been doing this. We launched and we started out with pretty simple location-based services, geofencing, 2014. And really, we learned along the way that being near a car lot is not enough to present someone with a notification. We learned that in a lot of cities, a lot of car lots are near each other, and they're all out on the strip. And when someone's driving and they're at a traffic light in front, that doesn't mean they're shopping for a car. And so we did build in all kinds of things from time of day to dwell time. We're starting with, you mentioned Finastra and some of the work they do. They have an open platform. We're starting to be able to pull data from back-end systems to say, hey, what accounts does this person already have? And what are some of the products and services that can be helpful based on other information the bank already has about them? And similarly, we've done a lot of segmenting. We've realized that only certain audiences would make sense to present them with certain offers. So we're now tying back into financial institution systems to really understand even more information about people, not just their location, but other products and services they've consumed, how they do transactions, and be able to really customize and tailor that for them.
James, very curious from the extended point of view for you as a marketer, what surprises have you found once you've begun to understand, you know, both people's movement and time, some of the demographics, some of the psychographic? Have you had with any of your partners uncovered any things that, you know, really surprised you about the customer behavior?
That's a great question, Jason. I think the thing that surprises us most is the ability of a consumer to sort of be thinking about two purchases at the same time. A number of our clients will run different sorts of promotions concurrently, so they'll have a mortgage rate or a HELOC or an auto dealership rate running at the program running at the same time. And we'll find, based on the parameters Greg set out, persistence, dwell time, et cetera, you know, making sure someone's not doing 75 miles an hour while we're serving them notifications, but find out that they're looking at a lot of life's big purchases at the same time. And then helping our financial institution clients, you know, sift through that data and figure out, okay, they stopped by a car lot, but that was, they only did that once in the last weekend, but they went to four different Home Depots and home remodelers and architects. Really looks like in your, you know, if your loan team can follow up with HELOC information, they seem like really ripe candidates. And being able to hand off those leads on a Monday morning to a financial institution for whose audience was on a car lot or on a at a Home Depot on the weekend is really powerful.
Yeah, it seems to me if you could target who went to, you know, Bye Bye Baby, Bed Bath and Beyond, then the car lot, they're probably also buying a larger house because the little one is on the way.
Yeah, could be.
Yeah. So you work primarily with financial institutions, both banks and credit unions, and some healthcare companies. So I want to get into and understand part of that. I'd love to understand, so how have banks and the credit unions been adopting this? What are the most common use cases? What have been the most successful use cases?
So the most successful use cases have been really around, well, two things. I think there's sort of two threads this goes down. One is a lot of the community financial institutions that we work with are very into their community engagement. So they want to be part of the community. They want to differentiate based on that. They are not a big bank. They're not headquartered out of state. They're there and part of the community. And so for a lot of our clients, they're thinking about what are the events and the activities in the community that they're participating in, where they would like people who bank with them to understand that they're participating in those ways and like to invite them to be a part of it. So, you know, concrete example, we have banks that sponsor 5K or 10K runs in their town that are there, that have a little booth. They're giving away water bottles for runners. They use location to say, hey, if you're here, so are we. We'd love to, you know, congratulate you on your run today and give you a prize for just showing up. So that's kind of a cool community engagement. Well, I was talking with a bank here in Michigan yesterday that sponsors Big Brothers, Big Sisters in their community, and they do a bowling event, and they want, when people are anywhere near the bowling alley, to say, come in, bowl with us, and help raise money for Big Brothers. So sometimes it is that community engagement piece of it. Another piece of the community engagement can also be relationships with businesses in the community. There are several folks we work with who have special offers set up for their the people who bank with them. And if you're near one of those offers, to present with a notification of saying, hey, thanks for banking with us. You've got free dessert with two entrees at this restaurant tonight just because you're a member of the credit union or bank at the bank. The other sort of use cases really get into the products and services from the financial institution. That, you know, we talk to banks all the time that are saying, we're trying to figure out how to drive loan volume. We've got a target of this many auto loans or this many mortgages that we're trying to close this quarter. And really being thoughtful about those behaviors and seeing what people are doing and targeting what's really going to work, that's been a big point of success. And, you know, James mentioned a moment ago the idea of being able to follow up on, these are the people who are shopping for a home last weekend. These are the people who are going to Home Depot and look like they're doing a project. that rich data marries really well with some of the systems they already have in place to market and some pieces that they do sometimes by email, sometimes in walk-up when someone comes into a branch. But being able to have that information that, hey, this account holder is doing these things and here's the products we can have for them is a really good fit.
So how does the technology – go ahead, James. Greg.
I'm sorry. I was just going to add. It's James. I was just going to add to Greg's comment that in our work, we're working with community banks and community credit unions that have, you know, some have a marketing team of 10 with data slicers and in-house graphic design, and some of them have a marketing team of one who's also the HR trainer and is doing commercial loan biz dev. So to be able to serve both ends of that spectrum of really important community banking work means that we're able to serve up qualified leads and watch those marketers or those loan specialists look at the intent of their community. What are people intending to do, and how can they act on it to help them drive ROI on their cost required and their loan volume?
So, I'd love to hear a breakdown. You first, how does the location-based aspect of this work, and then on the back end, how are the analytics, you know, what tools are you giving, especially, you know, James, to your point, if you're a marketing team of one, you know, how are you helping them on the back end? Maybe Greg, you can start from how it works on site.
Sure, I can help with that. A couple things about how it works. We are very focused now on working with mobile banking technology providers. So in Larkey's original origin, we often were a standalone separate app, but really our big transition in the past year has been bundling our service right in with the mobile banking provider. So we met at the Finastra event. That is, we were invited to be there because we are now bundled in with their Malazai mobile banking app. And so from a consumer, from an end user point of view, it's not something that you have to download separately or do. It's just part of the mobile banking app and it's already there. So we have a lot of those relationships. We're always looking for more. So it's interesting to talk with providers about that. So then again, from the consumer perspective, you're not downloading anything special. It's just part of your mobile banking app. We have a couple of things that we watch very carefully and we're very, want to make sure that they stay front in the foreground for us. One of those is battery usage. We do not do always on GPS, and we are constantly making sure that we're not showing up on the battery charts. We've learned in the past 5 years of doing this that people have become very good at looking at what's using battery on their mobile devices, and we want to make sure we're not on the list. So we are always.
Is that a privacy issue, or is that the I don't want to run out of juice issue, or is it kind of a both?
That one is I don't want out of juice. I was going to go to the privacy one next. That was the second one we always keep front of mind. So that's the privacy one. And part of the way we don't use battery is we are not always on and always storing people's location. We work with folks to say, hey, what are the important locations in your community where you want to know if someone's there and you can provide something useful to them? So, hey, it may be a car lot because you're doing auto loan. There's a credit union we work with in Utah that has a great deal for their members where it's, I think it's $15 off a ski lift ticket. And so that's one of those, hey, if you're at that ski resort, they can know that and they can provide you a $15 discount. And you know, privacy is a really interesting subject that we think a lot about and we talk a lot about. And we can get into it more if you'd like, but sort of the top of the concept from us is, if we're asking people to enable location-driven communications, we have to provide them something very valuable to do that. I think back on when Google first started Gmail and people said, no way, I'm not going to let Google read my mail. They're going to advertise to me. And then it provided a high enough value and convenience factor that most of us use Gmail now, let's say everybody. Same with, you know, smart speakers in people's homes. There are definitely many people who aren't comfortable with that yet. I applaud them. That's fine. But there's a lot of us that said, I really like the convenience of just saying something and having magically, I know the weather or a timer set or whatever convenient thing you use for, my lights go on, whatever those things are. So as we think about location services, we are respectful of people's privacy. We never sell data to anybody outside. It's always just between the financial institution and their clients. And we want to make sure that there's high value there. So there's a really compelling reason for people to enable it.
So James, talk to me about the back end piece of this. This is rich data. You've helped solve for some of the concerns around privacy and other. Now, this is coming back. How do you keep that marketer from just going, sweet, I'm going to do a standard type of promotion? Where does the sophistication begin to come in there?
Sure. That's a great question. So, We offer a really easy to use dashboard. So if you can imagine the dashboard that a marketer would be using, whether it's Hootsuite or Buffer or anything like that to schedule tweets, they use something very similar to schedule their nudges, as we call them. Their geolocation, whether it's welcoming you to opening day at the ballpark, which is an important thing that, you know, Greg began to touch on engagement a little bit. But one of the other problems we help our financial institutions solve is that notion that they need to engage, they need to stay in front of their audience that doesn't quite make it into the branch. So we have sort of that pocket of help for them as well. Welcoming people to a ball game, doing any kind of setting up notifications for auto loans, for HELOCs, for mortgages. We have credit unions and community banks that'll set up notifications in this dashboard as fast as you can set up a tweet that'll be for the open houses in their community that particular weekend, because they want to know whom of their audience, whom of their qualified creditworthy customers are shopping for a new house. The important piece about that is, and where this data gets powerful, is we're not telling a credit union or a community bank, hey, someone just bought a house. We get to talk to them about intent. It looks like this person, these 10 people, these 200 people are all in the market to buy a house, and we're able to serve that data. I made a point a moment ago that we have, you know, community banks and credit unions we work with one marketer or 10 marketers. We can also sort of shape the data they get back to meet that. So they can get, you know, data as a CSV file and just have a look at it, or they can include it and ingest it into their whatever BI system they're using.
So of the banks that have been most successful, what are the use cases that are really starting to drive the ROI for them? And what are things that people would have thought, oh, this is obviously a use case, that have turned out actually to be a bit of a red herring?
I think the one that they're often surprised by is how well HELOCs work. HELOCs are really interesting because if you think about the sociodemographic spectrum of people who belong to community bank or credit union, you've got, frankly, from your DIYers up to your, hey, honey, let's blow a wall out of the kitchen and really make that open kitchen concept we've always wanted. So you have one end of your audience that's going to Home Depot or Lowe's or wherever, and we'll put geofences around that, and they may walk in thinking they're going to buy paint and flooring and walk out with new appliances. To the other end of the spectrum, where they'll put geofences around architects' offices, general contractors in their town, to, again, get into the consideration cycle of those account holders as they're walking into those buildings, so that they're reminded, hey, your community bank or credit union is looking out for you and has a great pre-approved offer for you on a HELOC. I think HELOCs in particular, you're right, everybody talks about restaurant deals or car deals, which are super important, but it really is the HELOCs, I think, that are surprising a lot of us. Same is true with personal loans. A lot of our clients run skip-a-pay campaigns. I hadn't heard of this concept before, but there's something called Blue Monday that a good number of our clients focus on, which is roughly the third Monday in January, which is when people start to get the bills in the mail, finding out how much they overspent on their credit cards in December. And a lot of credit union community banks will target personal loans or skip-a-pay campaigns to their audience at that time. And they'll do that with, you know, wrapping our technology around their other parts of their marketing campaigns.
Interesting. I hadn't heard of Blue Monday before, but I can definitely see that being an interesting time when people are highly motivated to change some of their behaviors.
Sure.
I'm curious, you know, we are living in a time where data privacy is simultaneously a top concern, and at the same time, people seem to be giving their data away for, you know, less and less in signing up for things. What's your perspective on, you know, where this idea of location-based services is going to fall from a data privacy point of view?
I think, you know, there's legislation that's gone into effect in Europe. There's legislation coming in California. And I think some of the tenets of those legislative things that have already passed are going to take hold across the country. And those are really, you know, people have rights to understand what data is being collected and how that data is being used. People have rights to see what that data is, what exactly is being collected. People have rights to wipe out that data. We're on board with all that stuff. But I think it goes back to something I said a moment ago. It challenges those of us who use location services to make sure that we're providing value in doing this, that it's not just, you know, there's a lot of bad buzz a year or so ago about weather apps that were basically collecting location data so they could resell it to other sources. that's not a really useful thing for consumers. That's not helping them in any sort of way. So I think it's going to create more of a dynamic where you need to prove to people pretty quickly and pretty frequently that there's a reason that that data is worth sharing. And once you can provide that value for them, then it makes more sense for them to continue to enable that.
I'm curious, from the bank and credit union point of view, what kind of pushback are you getting from them?
On the privacy side or other
people? Just broadly, how are banks responding?
I think very well. What we're trying to work on with them is this idea of efficient marketing, that, you know, they look at what their budgets are to reach the world. And so they think about print advertising, and some of them think, oh, we're doing all kinds of great things. We're on, you know, Spotify, we're on Pandora, we're on social media. But really, that bridging that gap, that in the moment where one of our account holders is making a purchase decision, are they really remembering you? And so we're sort of the small dollar insurance policy to make sure that, hey, you know, you've spent $1 million plus, or, you know, whatever your budget is, you're a small financial institution or a big one, you spent a bunch of money, you've done a bunch of work, why leave it to chance that at that last moment when someone's making the decision, you're hoping that they just remember the 6 billboards they saw while they were driving, or the ad they saw while they were in the branch? So I think on that side, there's a lot of excitement around it. We have larger, pretty sophisticated clients who've got pretty detailed business analytics systems who are really interested in the data, who just go at it with, we want to customize what we're able to offer folks. So, you know, I think, I don't know if you use Quora, if listeners use Quora, but I use Quora a lot to find out all kinds of random information. And Quora clearly tracks what I click on. If someone doesn't know it, you can check it out at Quora.com. It's not my site or anything. But I know that when I get an email from Quora, it's often about music, entertainment, or some sort of fitness working out thing, because those are things I care about. I would drop the service in a flash if they kept sending me things about sports and NFL teams, because that's just not my thing. So I think people are getting used to a world where the data that you want, the information that's presented to you, has to be relevant to things you're interested in, and we can do it.
You know, Jim Marus of The Financial Brand and I had this conversation. Well, actually, we've been having it repeatedly, sadly, but, you know, American Express, who's widely thought of as, like, you know, the king or queen of offers and personalization. It's like every time they send me these monthly offers, I'm like, do you even know who I am? You know, it almost begins to work against them that I'm like, I've never used one of your offers. The only time I open it is so that I can continue to be frustrated that, like, you send me things that I would never purchase.
Right.
So it's, you know, it's interesting how I liked your Gmail analogy, that if there's value there, I'm going to be willing to contribute and to open it up. Now, I'm curious, you also serve the healthcare industry. What kinds of applications are people doing, and what's the use case? Is there anything that our financial service companies can learn from?
Possibly. It's an interesting question. So in the healthcare, there's an interesting dynamic, right? So people pay health insurance, or a chunk of their health insurance. They tend to forget that when they have a claim, they have a copay. And so there's a lot of sort of bad feelings towards health insurance companies. I'll stay out of this, that's right or wrong. And so for a lot of health insurance providers, they wanted to give some sort of discounts or offers or some sort of breaks to the people that have insurance to them to thank them and to show appreciation. But I think the interesting twist on it, where there may be relevance, more relevance for financial institutions, is they wanted to steer certain behaviors. So they don't necessarily want to be preachy about what people should and shouldn't be doing or eating, but the health insurance providers we work with challenged us a bit to say, hey, you know, the offers we want to provide to people aren't just, you know, restaurants and bars in town. They're things like bike rental or gym membership or a climbing wall. So what things can we put in that are on message and on brand? And so I think for the financial institutions, that's an interesting thought process too. We've had a lot of discussions with financial institutions about financial education and financial wellness and looking at people's behaviors. And if they're stopping at the coffee shop 7 times a week, that's probably not the best use of funds to do that. But again, not being preachy, but are there certain sorts of behaviors that can be incentivized or encouraged through location-driven communications that would be helpful for people's financial well-being? I think it's a really interesting topic to go into.
Well, I like the thread you started to pull on there, that often the most interesting insights are the non-obvious ones. I shouldn't say often. Almost always they're the non-obvious ones where, you know, person is on car lot, send car loan, you know, that it's about understanding behaviors more deeply and further afield. Have you guys partnered at all with anyone using artificial intelligence? Are you developing things on your own to help drive some of those insights?
We are starting to do some work with artificial intelligence to look at people's behaviors and how they respond to these things and what are more appropriate in terms of notifications. We're always interested in partnering. If there's folks that you or others recommend, we're always interested in not building everything on our own, but working with some smart people who've covered that ground already and staying focused on the location side of things.
Nice. Well, as we start to wrap up, what message do you want our listeners to take away from today's segment?
It's a good question. I mean, I think the real message that we think about is, banking has evolved from a point where people would be forced, I would say, to visit a branch that was in a specific location. I'm talking about like 100 years ago. And, you went, there were banker hours. I think that got sort of extended when hours became longer. I think the next evolution was maybe ATMs. Or, hey, you don't have to go into the bank to get 20 bucks. You can actually go to multiple locations around town, maybe even after hours. Then I think there's this idea of now you can go online and you can use your phone, and that's all good. But it's still sort of a request from consumers that I need something. I think there's this idea of sort of ambient banking of what's going to happen when you can sort of sense what people are looking for and as a bank or financial institution, reach out to them and be there and be ready to help, not wait for their request to come in. So I would challenge people and I'd ask people to think about, what can you as a financial institution do to be more proactive in a helpful way to make sure that you're serving people and that you're matching up the products and services you have with the needs that they have, not waiting for them to knock on your door or even open the app on their phone or go to your website, but to be thoughtful about providing them the things they need before they even might know they need them.
So the bankers need to get out from behind those teller windows and get into the places that people might be consuming those financial services.
Yeah.
I think that's right. I think enabling bankers in the community to engage where the people are, where the audience is, as opposed to waiting for the audience, waiting for your account holders to come to you is incredibly important, especially as we think about things like intent and consideration cycles and how close is someone to making that big purchase or how important is it to that person to be a member of a community institution.
Fantastic. Well, we are out of time. Thank you to Greg and James for joining us from Larky. They are Larky, LARKY.com. And thanks in the first segment, Peter Hazelhurst, telling us how Uber is becoming the Uber of financial services in the direction they're headed. If you've enjoyed this show, we always appreciate your feedback. Feel free to send us a message at BreakingBanks1 on Twitter or info@provoke.fm. And make sure you go to provoke.fm and check out the new Finovate podcast and the Tech on Reg podcast. And coming soon, we're going to have a couple other new podcasts launching. And most of all, if you liked it, share us with a friend. That's all for this week's Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time for more of the latest in fintech news.